The first time Lee went to purchase crack cocaine in the 1980s, he had a three-piece suit on. As a matter of fact, he was dressed so well that the dealer thought he was a police officer. So he handed him a bowl with a rock in it to make him prove otherwise and told him to smoke it. So Lee got clever and always wore a suit so he could get a free hit, and by the time he'd been using for months, he was nearly homeless and tattered rags for clothing. Lee told his own story of addiction, and he described spiraling into drug use similar to a scale. He says he started normal in the middle, and then he used crack, and he was higher than a cumulonimbus cloud, and then you're back to normal after you come down, but since you've been so high, well, normal doesn't feel so normal anymore. So then you need more and more and more just to get to the same spot until eventually taking the drug is so normal. It's the only thing that can make you feel normal. Here's how Lee talks about the early days of the crack explosion in the 1980s. He said, quote, "People don't become addicts because they get up one day and say, well, it's Tuesday. I think I'll go out and destroy my life. In the early days, we thought crack was not addictive. Gee, I can get up, get high, and then I can go to work the next day. We thought people were getting rich on it. It let people without a lot of money be players. In a lot of ways, that first few years or half year was a good time. There was money flowing in and around the streets. One day a brother would come draped in gold and he's got cars and shoeboxes full of money. For a while, it felt like that. Then it became something very, very ugly. And I think everybody's individual experiences are like that. It was paradise for a while. And then it became very, very ugly. And part of that ugliness is knowing you can get arrested. And part of that ugliness is desperation to get more. And part of that ugliness is when you start taking stuff out of your house and selling it. My personal bottom was when I ran off with a close friend's bank card and didn't come back until I'd taken $5,000 out of the account. I'd never done this. I had gone through 12 years of getting high without crossing that line, and that was my line. And then I went and sought help. And it wasn't easy to get, but that's almost a good thing because you want it as bad as you wanted those drugs. And I know when I wanted to get high, I didn't stop. So when I wanted to get clean, you got to chase that like crack. And that's the honest truth." Unquote. Now let's zoom out for a moment, shall we? Because aside from the very real addiction crisis of individual consumers, we also have to switch from zoom to a wide angle lens. Crack cocaine dominated the drug world in the 1980s and 1990s. So to understand why this caused such a moral panic and was even called an epidemic in the first place, we have to ask a series of questions. We know that cocaine ravaged and ruined countless lives and fueled mass incarceration. That is indisputable. But what is the history of the war on drugs? And if we dig deeper into history, what was the moment when America associated drug use with race? I mean, when does the prevailing narrative about drug use in America become associated as a stigma tied to black people and other communities of color? How was the crack cocaine business reflective of the amoral American style of swaggering capitalism? Did crack use cause crack babies? Did the CIA flood cocaine into black communities in Los Angeles and ignite the crack epidemic? We will investigate these questions and more in this episode. This is a story of drugs and addiction and capitalism and dealers and the U.S. government and lies and cover-ups and prisons. This is the Humanity Archive Podcast. Welcome back, everyone. I am Jermaine Fowler. Let's get into it. There is a problem with our history in America. Textbooks don't go deep enough. The marginalized are erased from our national narratives. The raw truths of our collective past are overlooked. And that's where the Humanity Archive comes in. Here I bring you a bone marrow deep life and death reality of human existence. Connecting past to present, because what use is history if it is not useful to the present? And to continue producing these lessons, I'm asking you, dear listener, to become a financial supporter of the Humanity Archive right now so I can continue sharing not just what happened, but why. And you can do that in two ways. Number one, pause this episode right now. Head over to thehumanityarchive.com/books. Order my book from your favorite retailer. It's at Barnes & Noble. It's at Amazon. It's at Bookshop, where you can order it from a local bookstore. All the links are there. And Amazon won't even charge you until the book comes out in February. It's called The Humanity Archive, Recovering the Soul of Black History from a Whitewashed American Myth. That is the name, and you can get it for $28.99. And that's 400 pages of hard-hitting history, honest history, just like in the podcast, narrated by yours truly. It's very personal. I work so hard on the book. Pick it up. And then after you purchase the book, go back to that same books page and put in your order number. And I have some free gifts I'm going to send to your email once you do that. Now, here's the second way you can support the Humanity Archive. And this is a recurring way. And if you can spare $5 per month every month, go to patreon.com/thehumanityarchive so we can keep producing this show. And if you don't have $5, well, you could donate $1 a month. You can donate $2 a month. I want everybody to be able to support this content, so there's no barrier. So whatever you can do, head over to Patreon and set up a monthly donation. Thank you so much. Now let's get into the crack epidemic episode. Erythroxylin coca. That is the scientific identifier for coca leaves, which grow from tropical shrubs widely cultivated in the Andean ridges of South America. Throughout the history of the Incan Empire, it was used as a medicine and local anesthetic. As a matter of fact, the word itself is derived from the Incan word cuca. And archaeologists believe that the plant was being used as early as 7,000 years ago. And we must be clear that the way this plant was being used then is alien from how we might understand it today as a narcotic. Cocaine, as we understand it in America, is extracted, concentrated, and in most cases processed chemically. But the cocaine alkaloid in its natural form amounts to less than 0.1% of the leaf. So we might look at the coca leaf as the ancient Andean double espresso. Still addictive, but not as potent. It was revered as a sacred object possessing spiritual powers. The leaf was chewed by priests to induce a trance-like state. They also chewed the leaf to overcome pain and fatigue and exhaustion, which came from working in those high altitudes. Now, to understand the stigma associated with this drug, we can begin our story here, because after the conquest of South American tribal lands by the Spaniards, the church sought to ban the chewing of these coca leaves as part of their attempt to extinguish ancient Andean spiritual traditions. We're talking back in the 1400s, 1500s here. So you had these Jesuit priests who were the first prohibitionists and who would directly link the use of cocaine to the other, to an indigenous identity, to an uncivilized practice, as something dark, as something unholy. Now, keep this in mind as we fast forward then into the 19th century, when Europeans and Americans became infatuated with cocaine, infatuated with heroin, infatuated with morphine, infatuated with opioids. And none of this was illegal, and doctors prescribed all of these things over the counter. You could soothe your teething child with Miss Winslow's soothing syrup with the special ingredient of morphine. There were cocaine toothache drops. When John Pemberton invented Coca-Cola as a patented medicine in 1886, up until 1904, it had around 9 milligrams of cocaine in each and every single glass. The first advertisement, as a matter of fact, for the beverage Coca-Cola read, quote, "Coca-Cola syrup and extract for soda water and other carbonated beverages. This intellectual beverage and temperance drink contains the valuable tonic and nerve stimulant properties of the coca plant and cola nuts, and makes not only a delicious, exhilarating, refreshing, and invigorating beverage, but a valuable brain tonic. and cure for all nervous affections, sick headache, neuralgia, hysteria, melancholy, etc. The peculiar flavor of Coca-Cola delights every palate. It is dispensed from the soda fountain in the same manner as any fruit syrups. Unquote. How's that for marketing? Now, a lot of people don't know this, but for a long time, Coca-Cola was only dispensed from segregated drink dispensers. So if you are black or brown or red, for that matter, you aren't getting any Coke. Literally. And we can't imagine that now, can we? Imagine turning on the TV right now. You're going in to watch your favorite streaming show. And then one of those annoying ads popped up. But this one is for cocaine. One article I read said it was a phenomenon in America and Europe. Before Coca-Cola, there was a wine elixir that had cocaine in it that was enjoyed by Queen Victoria, rabbis, popes, President Ulysses S. Grant, inventor Thomas Edison, and many others. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Everybody was on cocaine, unquote. In a letter to his future wife, Martha Bernays, in 1886, famed psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud wrote, quote, "Here I am, making silly confessions to you, my sweet darling, and really without any reason whatever, unless it is the cocaine that makes me talk so much," unquote. It is estimated that 1 in 200 people were addicted to cocaine around 1899. I know a lot of Victorian era TV shows are popular, and they really should feature a lot more cocaine in those to make it historically accurate. It surely didn't hurt the branding that it was billed as, quote, "a most wonderful invigorator of sexual organs," unquote. But as time went on, cocaine began to fall out of favor in white America because all these physicians and doctors and well-to-do people were becoming addicted to it, and it had some very nasty side effects and social repercussions. Now, remember earlier we explored this idea that what is associated with whiteness has ultimately been seen as less harmful. But then when it comes to the indigenous, when it comes to people who are not white, you see it become denigrated. In other words, white people on cocaine throughout history haven't been so criminalized and dehumanized because of it. And now that we've excavated the history of cocaine, we are about to lay the foundations for this so-called crack epidemic that came about in the 1980s. And for this, we can go back to a New York Times article written in 1914 by a medical doctor named Edward Huntington Williams. And it read, quote, "Negro cocaine fiends are a new southern menace. Murder and insanity increasing among lower class blacks because they have taken to sniffing since deprived of whiskey by prohibition," unquote. I could read this stuff 1,000 times and it never ceases to shock me that such racist things were written by highly respectable publications back then. Whether it was highly respectable now, we can look back with question, but they were back then. But here we get to see the power of myth at work, the power of who shapes the narrative at work, and the power of who shapes the story at work, and how myth shapes people's ideas of good and evil, right and wrong, guilt and innocence, civilized or savage. The modern media coverage and racial stigma of drug use can be traced back to articles like this, where Dr. Williams goes on to say, quote, "For some years, there have been rumors about the increase in drug taking in the South. Vague but always insistent rumors that the addiction to drugs, morphine, and cocaine was becoming a veritable curse to the colored face in certain regions." He goes on, quote, "The Negro fiend imagines that he hears people taunting and abusing him, and this often incites homicidal attacks upon innocent and unsuspecting victims. The deadly accuracy of the cocaine user has become axiomatic in Southern police circles. The record of the cocaine nigger near Asheville who dropped 5 men dead in their tracks using only 1 cartridge for each offers evidence that is sufficiently convincing," unquote. I don't use that N-word lightly, but we have to be able to sit with the gravity and the weight of the word in the context of the history. And now we can start to connect the dots past to present, right? Nobody ever called Ulysses S. Grant or Queen Victoria a dope fiend, right? And let's be clear on the definition of that word fiend, because that word fiend is always associated with black people, people of color, addicted to drugs. Gotta look at the nuance of words, right? The meaning of words, right? The history of words, right? Fiend means evil spirit or demon or wicked or cruel person. So this image of The black dope fiend not only fueled lynchings, but began to shape national drug policy, laws, and enforcement. And over the years, the language evolves, but politicians are still speaking to the same fears and using similar rhetoric. And then you come to 1981 when President Ronald Reagan spoke about, quote, the utopian presumptions about human nature. Talking to the International Association of the Chiefs of Police, he said, quote, just during the time you and I are together today, at least one person will be murdered, 9 women will be raped, 67 other Americans will be robbed, 97 will be seriously assaulted, and 389 homes will be burglarized. This all will happen in the next 30 minutes, Reagan said this as he began his speech. And then he goes on to say, quote, police chiefs lead the thin blue line that holds back a jungle which threatens to reclaim this clearing we call civilization, unquote. And this is how the political machinery has stayed well-oiled in the United States for a long time, isn't it? With dog whistles and coded language and playing to the fears, targeting your basest emotional responses by setting up a boogeyman, the crack addict lurking outside to rob your home and get a fix, the predatorial hustler preying on the vulnerable who would sell a rock to a pregnant woman to make a dollar. So we know there is a grain of truth in some of this, right? These are outliers. There are people who would break in your home to get a fixed are people who would sell a crack rock to a pregnant woman and have. But again, these are the outliers. So you make it seem as though the outlier is normal. Get people riled up and then they are okay that you want to send hundreds of police officers into black communities to patrol, right? And lock them up. They blow the thing up so tremendously and unrecognizably that people are so scared they agreed to lock people up and throw away the key rather than focus on more humane solutions like rehabilitation, diversion, counseling, job readiness, all these other things that can steer people away from these lives that end up becoming intertwined with drug use and drug dealing. So then we get this war on drugs, and a lot of people think that the war on drugs began in the 1980s, but we have to go back a little further to the 1930s. And remember, during this time, the general public's attitudes toward drug use were conflicted, but certainly not excessively harsh or draconian like they are now in terms of it being normal to sentence someone for 10, 20, 30 years for nonviolent drug offenses. But I want you to remember the name Harry Anslinger. He was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and held that position from 1930 until 1962. And this guy ruthlessly pursued drug users, and his propaganda helped to outlaw opioids, marijuana, and cocaine. One book said, quote, Anslinger was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, unquote. And this isn't to say that drugs shouldn't be regulated or that they aren't addictive at all. But we're talking about ruining lives here. For nonviolent mistakes, we are talking about stringent drug laws and terribly long prison sentences for nonviolent drug users and sellers that literally created the prison industrial complex. And we are talking about a system inherently unequal for black people and other people of color from the very beginnings. Listen to this quote from Anslinger, the man who shaped modern drug policy in America. That's not an understatement. He said, quote, there are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing resulted from marijuana usage. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and many others. Colored students at the University of Minnesota partying with white female students, smoking marijuana and getting their sympathy with stories of racial persecution. Result, pregnancy. Reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men. Unquote. Ooh, gets right to the core, doesn't he? White male fear of the black male body. White male fear of the black male with the white woman. Let that sink in like an anchor in the ocean. A man who said these words shaped the drug policies that still disproportionately affect black people today. That's why they say our history is carried with us. And then you get to the Controlled Substances Acts coming out of the 1970s and the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act that established mandatory minimum sentences. And then you get things like the 100-to-1 ratio between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. And what that meant was that the possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine would mandate the same minimum sentence as 500 grams of powder cocaine. Why? because cocaine was the drug of choice of white people, crack was affecting black communities. And then by 2005, you see that black people made up more than 80% of those sentenced to federal prison for crack cocaine offenses, even though 2/3 of crack cocaine users were white and Hispanic. Richard Nixon's domestic policy advisor, John Ehrlichman, revealed in a 1994 interview that the war on drugs had begun as a racially motivated crusade to criminalize blacks and the anti-war left. He said, quote, "We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or blacks. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin and then criminalizing them both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night in the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did," unquote. A lot of times when these politicians are far removed from any threat of persecution or in their older age or on their deathbeds, they'll come out and tell you the reasons they did things. Now, this history is bad enough, but let's explore the 80s a bit more, shall we? Because this is the era where crack and cocaine really became a national focus. And we know there is a very real history of racist hate mongers creating our national drug policy. But I want to touch on a conspiracy theory that has had very long staying power, especially in the black community. And when I say conspiracy, I'm simply talking about something that is possible but not provable. Some more possible than others, and some conspiracies have evidence piled up so high against them that we really shouldn't even entertain them, should we? But there is one that has stuck around, and that is the one that says the CIA flooded black communities with crack cocaine in the 1980s. Now, this sounds totally possible, right? And there are many cases of officers and federal agents who have been involved in the drug trade and corruption. But the evidence doesn't quite add up to a secret governmental plan to get masses of black people hooked on crack. It just doesn't. So maybe it's true, but to make a claim that big, you're going to have to back it up with evidence, right? But who am I kidding? A part of me still believes it. Hard evidence or not. Because it's just so damn believable that the CIA worked through South American drug producers to distribute crack in black communities. I mean, there may not be hard evidence that they did, but there isn't any that they didn't either. And I just think that with the history of racism tied to drug policy, well, we can see how so many black people, paranoid and distrustful of the government, would say this is true. Now let's get back to this so-called crack epidemic, which addiction researchers say is a misnomer. In a study on cocaine use, they said that politicians and journalists called this an epidemic in spite of the evidence. They said the word epidemic should only be used for disease or disease-like conditions that are widespread or prevalent in the USA, and that use of cocaine peaked in 1982 before crack even hit the scene. So they didn't say that white people were facing a cocaine epidemic. See, the fear-mongering. So this framing is still used today. You can look it up today, the crack epidemic. You're going to find all kinds of information. And we know that it's at best a half-truth, because the problem then in the black community has to be solved, right? It has to be solved by more officers, by locking black people up. It has to be solved, creating a problem to then pose the solution. So you get this framing again where it's this huge social issue and it's largely framed as a black problem with black addicts and instantaneous addictions, drug use associated with criminality, which was used for justification, again, to fill prisons. And a lot of people did get caught up in the cycle of street dealing. In 1984, the unemployment rate for black teens was around 40%. I think about how many young men bet their lives and still bet their lives investing in selling rock cocaine, invested in selling drugs, fentanyl, methamphetamines, opioids of all sorts and kinds. So many drugs come out now. Who can even keep up? And remember, this was the 1980s, which was an era that championed a free market maverick kind of capitalism. But when you have a system that favors competition and there are only so many street corners from which to sell your crack, and you involve guns, and crack is about the only get rich scheme around, well, people are going to try to move you off that corner. So then you get the violence. So you get this cycle of buying and selling and investing and profiting and organizing business on a global scale. It just so happened to be in the drug trade. But these street level dealers, right? It's the American way. You get the trappings of capitalism, the clothes, the jewels, the cars, the high life. And a lot of these dealers and users are getting caught. So then they get out of jail and they go back to the comfort of the crack pipe, or they go back to the relatively easy money by distributing the cocaine, which made its way from South America, usually smuggled through Mexico and the Bahamas and the Dominican Republic. And you get the gangsterism and you get the dishonesty and you get the wars over product and the death that comes with all of that. And that's where the focus went, all while Wall Street was saying that greed is good in the 80s. And we're also involved in devious activities, insider trading, market manipulation, preying on the vulnerable. But there was no massive and merciless legal apparatus set up for them. American hypocrisy. And now into the present, we still have the same alarmist reaction to that all-American drug problem. The demand has never gone away for drugs. Remember that. Whether it be for the utility of the products we can make from plants in Jamestown, Virginia, for example, colonists were required by law to grow cannabis for the utility of hemp. It has a very wide range of uses and it's easy to grow. There's always been a demand for what we might call drugs in that way, whether it be for utility or whether there was a demand for drugs to cure headaches or fatigue or people just wanted to get high and have a good time. We still have wine. We still have caffeine. We still have alcohol. Cannabis is legal in a lot of states now, so a lot of these things are more or less addictive. America has a long history and love affair with drugs, with plants, and that relationship hasn't always been a healthy one now, has it? Still having sentences based on drug type, quantity, and purity of drugs rather than a focus on rehabilitation, prevention, and focus on violence. So I think about the racism. I think about how many people are struggling with addiction now. I lost friends to addiction. So this is a very personal episode for me, or how many people got caught selling crack for the first time or sentenced to 10 to 12 years. Personally, know people have been in this situation. That is a legacy of the 1980s crack policy today and why America has so much trouble figuring out its drug problem. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in to the Humanity Archive podcast. And yeah, please remember, support this important work. Buy the book, $28.99. TheHumanityArchive.com/books. It's going to take you to any bookseller that you would want to buy it from. And also, become a recurring supporter so we can keep the show coming. $1, $5, whatever you can afford. Go over to Patreon.com/TheHumanityArchive. Thank you all for listening. I love you all. I'll see you next time.